Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 10. I'm going to do the first 15 verses, and I'll entitle this section, The Sun Stands Still in the Valley of Ajalon. Our context is this. In the last chapter, we see how the pagans at Gibeon, which is about 4 or 5 miles northwest of Jerusalem, about 20 miles west of Gilgal, where the Israelites were camped, they came pretending they were from a long way off, and so therefore the rules about the Israelites being able to offer terms without destroying the city completely, those were the rules for cities that were far away, and so they said, we're far away, we want easier terms, we want to enter into a treaty with you. And when Joshua found out about it, he says, well, we're not going to kill you because we made the treaty, but you're going to be our slaves, either the slaves of the congregation or slaves of us individually. So that was the last chapter. Now, here we are in chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Now, it came about when Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land, that he feared greatly, that he is fearing greatly as the king of Jerusalem, Adonizedek. He feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Now this name Jerusalem perhaps was given in anticipation. Maybe it was not named Jerusalem when Joshua got there. Israel seems to have given the name to Jerusalem when they got possession of it. Let me read you from Easton's Dictionary some interesting facts about this famous city. It was also called Salem. It's also called Ariel. It's also called Jebus, J-E-B-U-S. It was called the City of God and the Holy City by modern Arabs. Once it was called the City of Judah. The name is in the original in the dual form and means possession of peace. The dual form, I think that what Easton's means here is not just Salem, but Jerusalem. Salem means peace. Jerusalem means possession of peace or foundation of peace. The dual form probably refers to the two mountains on which it was built, viz. Zion and Moriah. Zion being the southern mountain, a hill, and Moriah being the northern hill. Or, as some suppose, to the two parts of the city, the upper and the lower city. Jerusalem is a mountain city enthroned on a mountain fastness. It stands on the edge of one of the highest tablelands in Palestine. It is surrounded on the southeastern, the southern, and western sides by deep and precipitous ravines. I remember being on a tourist bus coming up from the Jordan River to Jerusalem, and I said, this bus is at a 45-degree angle, and it's going about 20 miles an hour. This hill is so steep getting us to Jerusalem. I was amazed at how high Jerusalem was. Returning to Easton's, it is first mentioned in Scripture under the name Salem, Genesis 14:18. When first mentioned under the name Jerusalem, Adonizedek was its king. That's here in Joshua 10:1, first mention of Jerusalem. It is afterwards named among the cities of Benjamin, but in the time of David it was divided between Benjamin and Judah. Remember, the dividing line between Benjamin and Judah runs right through the middle of Jerusalem. After the death of Joshua, the city was taken and set on fire by the men of Judah, but the Jebusites were not wholly driven out of it. That's in Judges 1, chapter 1 through 8, which we'll get to shortly. The city is not mentioned again until we are told that David brought the head of Goliath thither. David afterwards led his forces against the Jebusites, still residing within its walls, and drove them out, fixing his own, David's own dwelling on Zion, which he called the City of David. Here he built an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Arona, the Jebusite, and thither he brought up the Ark of the Covenant and placed it in the new tabernacle which he prepared for it. Jerusalem now became the capital of the kingdom. So David was the one who finally ran all the Jebusites out and made Jerusalem the capital of Israel. Now, Adonizedek of Jerusalem heard that Gibeon had made peace. That's the story we looked at in the last chapter, how they snookered Israel into making a peace treaty with them. But however they did it, that didn't matter to Adonizedek. He had a strategic problem now. First of all, Gibeon was a great city, and it had mighty men in it, according to verse 2. And now Gibeon is allied with Israel. If you look at a map, Gibeon is 4 or 5 miles to the northeast of Jerusalem, or Jebus, as it was called back then, but Jerusalem. And then if you look from Jebus and go to Gilgal, you look at about another 10 miles to the northeast, maybe less than that, 7 or 8 miles. You got two cities, one to the northwest and one to the northeast, in alliance with one another. And oh boy, are we in trouble now. Because now one large city, namely Gibeon, is out of the anti-Israel coalition that all these paganite tribes had made, as we looked at earlier. So now Jerusalem's subjects, citizens, might be thinking making peace would be a good thing to do. And thus they were pressuring Adonizedek to give up Jerusalem's freedom. Just surrender to these guys. Rather be tributary than dead. The people of Jerusalem might be thinking, look, if one great city like Gibeon caved to the Israelites, maybe other great cities might cave to the Israelites and will be even more isolated. Now, Gibeon is called a royal city in verse 2, or like one of the royal cities. That gives us two options. It could be a royal city. It could mean that it is a royal city, a city in which a king resided. This is according to commentator Benson and Colin Delitzsch. Or it could be a city as powerful as one in which a king resided, but the king didn't actually reside there, because it says it's like a royal city. Doesn't really matter. The point is, it was powerful, more powerful than Ai, and its men were mighty. Now, the king of Jerusalem was called Adonizedek, and his name means Lord of Righteousness. And maybe that's an imitation of Melchizedek, who used to be from there. Remember the ancient patriarchal king of Jerusalem, who received the tithes from Abraham back in the early chapters of Genesis? As it turns out, Adonizedek means Lord of Righteousness, and Melchizedek means King of Righteousness. Those were common names for the kings of Jerusalem. It's interesting that you got righteousness there in the royal titles of those who ruled Jerusalem. We go now to Joshua 10, verses 3 and 4. Therefore, Adonizedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Yarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Eglon, saying, come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel. Now, these kings, I'm just going to call them the Amorite kings, or the five Amorite kings. That's what they're called later on in a later verse, so that's what we're going to call them. Hebron is a city to the south of Jerusalem, about halfway down the extent of the Dead Sea, on the western side of the Dead Sea. It's halfway between Jerusalem and Beersheba. Hebron is about 20 miles from Beersheba, and so it's about 20 miles from Jerusalem, Hebron is. Reading from Easton's, we can learn a lot of interesting stuff about Hebron. It was built 7 years before Zoan in Egypt. It still exists under the same name of Hebron, and it is one of the most ancient cities in the world. I looked that up on the Wikipedia, and sure enough, it's got a lot of people there. Its earlier name was Kiriath Arba, which means the city of a man named Arba. But Hebron would appear to have been the original name of the city, and it was not until after Abraham's stay there that it received the name Kiriath Arba. Arba, was not the founder, but the conqueror of the city, having led thither the tribe of the Anakim to which he belonged. It retained this name till it came into the possession of Caleb, when the Israelites restored it the original name Hebron. This is from Kyle and Delitzsch. The name of the city does not occur in any of the prophets or in the New Testament. It is found about 40 times in the Old. It was the favorite home of Abraham. Here he pitched his tent under the oaks of Mamre, by which name it came afterwards to be known. And here Sarah died and was buried in the cave of Machpelah, that's all at Hebron, which he brought from Ephron the Hittite, the cave of Machpelah. From this place the patriarch departed for Egypt by way of Beersheba. It was taken by Joshua, Hebron was, and given to Caleb. It became a Levitical city and a city of refuge. When David became king of Judah, this was his royal residence. And he resided here for 7.5 years, and here he was anointed as king over all Israel. It became the residence also of the rebellious Absalom, who probably expected to find his chief support in the tribe of Judah. So, of course, Hebron is a very famous city. It's interesting to see it's still here, one of the oldest cities in the world. I don't know whether it or Damascus is older, but they've been around a long, long time. Now let's look at these five kings that were allying themselves against Gibeon and Israel. First of all, we got Piram, king of Yarmuth. Yarmouth is about 10 miles southwest of Jerusalem. The name means height. That's all we need to know about Yarmouth. Next, we got Japhia, king of Lachish. Now, Lachish is a town that shows up in other Old Testament stories, so we might want to learn that. That's about 20 miles southwest of Jerusalem. Yarmouth is about 10 miles. So you see that Jerusalem is looking for allies to the south and the west toward the plains as you get down out of the hill, the mountain, or the hills of Judah. You're getting toward the coast, the Shephelah. And so he makes a deal with Lachish. Now, Lachish means impregnable. Nice name. It was a royal Canaanitish city in the Shephelah, Easton says, or maritime plain of Palestine. It was taken and destroyed by the Israelites. It afterwards became, under Rehoboam, one of the strongest fortresses of Judah. It was assaulted and probably taken by Sennacherib. Sennacherib, when is he? In the 701 B.C., somewhere around 700 B.C. And so Lachish shows up, as I said, in later Old Testament accounts. Some other interesting facts about Lachish. Excavations at Lachish are still going on. And among other discoveries is that of an iron blast furnace with slag and ashes, which is supposed to have existed B.C. 1500. If the theories of experts are correct, the use of the hot air blast instead of cold air, an improvement in iron manufacture patented by Nielsen in 1828, was known 1500 years before Christ. Interesting. That hot air instead of cold air blast furnace, that changed the face of Western civilization. It's a very, very famous invention, one of the key inventions of history, kind of like the light bulb, kind of like the steam engine. And maybe the people at Lachish came up with it first. But anyway, they allied themselves with Adonizedek of Jerusalem. And next we've got Debir, king of Eglon. Eglon is 2 or 3 miles to the southwest of Lachish, very close. And by the way, that's not Ekron. Ekron is a famous Philistine city later on. This is Eglon, a different city, still in the southwest area there. So that takes care of the five kings of the Amorites. Adonizedek of Jerusalem says, "Come up to me and help me. Let's attack Gibeon." Let's summarize the strategy here from John Gill. Quote, this attack, quote, "for which he thought himself not a match, not only because it was a great city and full of mighty men and had other cities subject to it, but because he might reasonably judge that Joshua would come to their assistance, if possible, being in league with him." Well, that's what I said at the very beginning of the discussion of verses 1 through 4. So we go now to Joshua 10, verses 5 through 6. So the five kings of the Amorites, and that's where they get the title from, and let's just stop right here and talk about the Amorites. There's two ways the word is used. There's a broad meaning and a narrow meaning. The narrow meaning stands for one of the Canaanite tribes, one of the tribes that lived in Canaan. But because that tribe was so strong, the term Amorite sometimes was used to refer to all the tribes of Canaan. Now, the five kings of the Amorites, I'm assuming that's the broad meaning of the Amorites, because it was the Hittites that lived in Hebron, the Jebusites lived in Jerusalem, and the Hivites lived in Gibeon, as we know from other earlier scriptures we've gone over. And so, more particularly, they weren't Amorites. But in general, they were Amorites because they were tribes in the land of Canaan. Adam Clark agrees with this. He says, quote, "Amorites is, quote, a general name for the inhabitants of Canaan, otherwise called Canaanites." That's another generalized name. There was a specific tribe called Canaan, and there was a general name for all the tribes, the whole body of tribes. That general name was also Canaanites. So let me start over. Clark says that Amorites is, quote, a general name for the inhabitants of Canaan, otherwise called Canaanites. And it is very likely that they had this appellation because the Amorites were the most powerful tribe or nation in that country. The inhabitants of Jerusalem were Jebusites. In Joshua 15:63, we see that. Those of Hebron were Hittites, Genesis 23:2-3. And the Gibeonites were Hivites, Joshua 9:7. And yet all these are called Amorites occasionally, probably for the reasons already mentioned, viz., because that tribe was most numerous and powerful. So now, when Gibeon saw all the five kings of the Amorites camped around their city, they sent message to Joshua at Gilgal. That's about one day's journey. It is one day's journey away, about 10 miles, and said, "Help! We're in trouble. We're in league with you now. Remember, we're your hewers of wood and drawers of water, and we need some help." Joshua 10, verses 7 and 8. So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the valiant warriors. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them, for I have given them into your hands. Not one of them shall stand before you." Now when it says all the people of war went with Joshua, that cannot mean all the 500,000 or 600,000 warriors he had at Gilgal. Such a large number would not be needed for this expedition. Some soldiers needed to stay behind at Gilgal to protect the old men, the women, the children, the lame, the sick, the halt. So what does all mean, all the people of war that went with Joshua? It means all that were picked to go with Joshua. That's all. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear them." Now Joshua would need encouragement at this juncture. He might not have felt that his alliance with Gibeon was a good one, since it was based on Gibeon's fraud. He might have felt that God might not back him up because he was so stupid to have entered into that alliance. Here's what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Quote, "The intelligence of so formidable a combination among the native princes seems to have depressed Joshua's mind with the anxious and dispiriting idea that it was a chastisement for the hasty and inconsiderate alliance entered into with the Gibeonites. It was evidently to be a struggle of life and death, not only to Gibeon, but to the Israelites. And in this view, the divine communication that was made to him was seasonable and animating. He seems to have asked the counsel of God and received an answer before setting out on the expedition." And I think that's entirely true. We go now to Joshua 10, verses 9 through 10. So Joshua came upon them suddenly, came upon the five tribes of the Amorites, came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal. Remember, it was a one-day journey from Gilgal, except they didn't do it in the daytime. They came at night. "And the Lord confounded them," that's the five tribes of the Amorites, "confounded them before Israel, and he slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon, and struck them as far as Azekah and Makkedah." Now, here are two things mentioned in verse 9, which shows that the Amorite kings were totally surprised. The fact that Joshua showed up so quickly, it says he came upon them suddenly. The five kings were not expecting all that. And a night attack coming up early in the morning, the sun comes up. Oh, there's an army. Because the army wasn't there last night because Joshua came from Gilgal, that 9 or 10 miles. Now, the five Amorite kings retreated from Gibeon, going northwest, trying to escape. It's about 5 miles or so, to a place called Beth-horon. The way of the ascent of Beth-horon. Now, they're trying to get out of the mountains here. There's mountains, that hill country, all around Gibeon. And as you go toward Beth-horon, there's an ascent, and it's in a ravine, and you're climbing up, and you go up about 500 feet. That's upper Beth-horon. Then there's a valley, and then you go down the descent from upper Beth-horon, and the bottom is called Beth-horon. It's also about couple miles, I think, further north at the other side of the valley. That's lower Beth-horon. And so that valley, as you're going from east to west, is how the kings escaped out of the hill country into the Shephelah, into the plains below. And the Israelites chased them the whole way. The reason they did is they wanted to deliver Gibeon. That was their first strategic objective. But the second strategic objective is to wipe these guys out so we won't have to worry about them later. Now, let me read you what Easton says about Beth-horon. It means house of the hollow or house of the cavern. It's the name of two towns or villages in the territory of Ephraim. That's upper and lower Beth-horon. On the way from Jerusalem to Yapa, they are distinguished as Beth-horon the upper and Beth-horon the nether or the lower. They're about 2 miles apart, the former being about 10 miles northwest of Jerusalem. Between the two places was the ascent and descent of Beth-horon, leading from Gibeon down to the western plain, down which the five kings of the Amorites were driven by Joshua in that great battle, the most important in which the Hebrews had been as yet engaged. Now notice that. Easton says that this battle against the five kings of the Amorites is more important than the battle against Jerusalem and the battle against Ai. The battle against Jericho and the battle against Ai. It was the most important, Easton says, being their first conflict with their enemies in the open field. Jehovah interposed in behalf of Israel by a terrific hailstone, which caused more deaths among the Canaanites than did the swords of the Israelites. We'll talk about that in a minute. Interesting rabbit trail here. Beth-horon, both upper and lower Beth-horon, is said to be built by Sherah, a daughter of Ephraim, 1 Chronicles 7:24. His daughter was Shirah, who built Lower and Upper Beth-horon. Now, my question is what does it mean to build? Does it mean to put a fortress on? Does it mean to open up some passes, put some bridges? I don't know, but you got a woman doing some construction work. That's interesting in those times of patriarchy. I think a lot of times we tend to forget that women, a lot of times in ancient medieval times and ancient times, had a lot of power. It wasn't officially recognized, but a lot of times women did a lot of stuff that you wouldn't think they would be doing, especially in the Middle Ages when women were supposed to be so subjugated. I mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine, she was rich as Croesus, rich as Donald Trump, and rich as Bill Gates. And she played the political game pretty hard, too. Matilda, the famous antagonist of Stephen of Blois, one of the kings that came right after William the Conqueror in England. Lots of examples like that. Edith, back in English history, back in the Anglo-Saxon times, back in the times of Edward the Confessor and before him, Canute and before him, Athelstan, all these acts. Oh, Edith was a big one. So, Shirah built Upper and Lower Beth-horon. Now, a place called Azekah is mentioned because as the five kings left Beth-horon, they went south to Azekah and Makkedah. Azekah is first. It's about 10 or 15 miles south-southwest of Jerusalem. If you look at the map, the name Azekah means dug over. It's a town in the Shephelah, low hills of Judah, which we know, where the five confederated Amoritish kings were defeated by Joshua and their army destroyed by a hailstorm. Actually, as we're going to see in the next verse, the hailstorm followed them all the way from Beth-horon for that 10 or 15 miles as they retreated, and they took their casualties. Azekah was one of the places reoccupied by the Jews when they returned from the captivity. Now, if you go down 10 miles further, south-southeast still, you end up at Makkedah, which is about 5 miles north of Lachish, which we've already mentioned. All of this is in the southwest of Jerusalem, right on the edge between the hill country and the Shephelah, the plains, heading toward the Mediterranean Sea. Makkedah means herdsman's palace, herdsman's place. Herdsmen don't have palaces. It's one of the royal cities of the Canaanites, near which was a cave where the five kings who had confederated against Israel sought refuge. And we will look at that in our next audio. They were put to death by Joshua, who afterwards suspended their bodies upon five trees. We go down to Joshua verse 11, chapter 10. As they fled, that's the five Amorite kings, as they fled from before Israel while they were at the descent of Beth-horon, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those from whom the sons of Israel more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with a sword. Now the day was far spent before the Gibeonites and their allies fled. Jameson Fawcett Brown says that. I don't know why he knows that. I guess he says because there's much hard fighting around Gibeon. All that fight went on for a good part of the day before they checked out and retreated toward the south. Now I've already mentioned the descent from Beth-horon, the path between Upper Beth-horon, which was the closest to the fleeing Amorites, kings, and the pursuing Israelites. That's the one that's 500 feet in the air, and Lower Beth-horon, which is on the other side of the valley there, about 2 miles away at ground level. We read Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, Upper Beth-horon was nearest Gibeon, about 10 miles distant, and approached by a gradual ascent through a long and precipitous ravine. This was the first stage of the flight. The fugitives had to cross the high ridge of Upper Beth-horon and were in full flight down the descent to Beth-horon, the lower. The road between the two places is so rocky and rugged that there is a path made by means of steps cut in the rock. Down this pass, Joshua continued his victorious route. So it's not really a plain, it's a stairway, a rock-cut stairway through the pass there between Upper and Lower Beth-horon. Here it was that the Lord interposed, assisting his people by means of a storm, which, having been probably gathering all day, burst with such irresistible fury. Now, we'll say this. Some people, this is kind of an off-the-wall theory. It says large stones from heaven. Some people say that as the Israelites were going down this rock-cut stairway, the Amorites were going down the stairway, that the Israelites were stationed above Upper Beth-horon, or at Upper Beth-horon, and were chunking rocks, chunking stones down on the retreating Amorites? I don't think so. I think it was a hailstorm. Well, I think most people do. That's just a possibility. Some people have even speculated there was meteorites coming, because it doesn't. The Hebrew is stones, but it's hailstones. Let's just assume that. Let me mention one other important, or not important, I should say, interesting fact about Beth Horon. All of you who are aficionados of Orthodox preterism, you will recall the famous story in Josephus where Cestus, the Roman general, arranged his troops outside of Jerusalem, and the people in Jerusalem looked out and they saw the abomination which causes desolation, i.e. Cestus's army. And then Cestus, for some unknown reason, withdraws from the walls of Jerusalem and heads north. He was captured at Beth Horon, tracked by the zealots inside the city who chased him up to Beth Horon and beat the mud out of him. So Beth Horon is an interesting place. But of course, if you're not an Orthodox preterist, or if you're not a reader of Josephus, you wouldn't know about that. But it's a very interesting thing, because while the Israelites were chasing Cestus up to Beth Horon, the Christians inside the city of Jerusalem, who were trapped in there by the crazy zealots beforehand, escaped, and they escaped to Pella, as Eusebius of Caesarea tells us, and not one of them got killed. And that's why Jesus said, when you see the abomination of desolation that causes desolation, flee the city. And they did. We go now to Joshua 10:12. Now this verse begins one of the most controversial passages in the scripture that has caused more intellectuals more time trying to explain. Joshua 10:12. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the sons of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, and O moon, in the valley of Ajalon. O moon, i.e. stand still in the valley of Ajalon. Well, before we get into what that meant, let's do some geography. Ajalon is about 5 miles south of Lower Beth Horon. It was on the way to Azekah, and Azekah was on the way to Machanah. Before we got to there, there's Ajalon first, about 5 miles. And of course, I'm assuming hailstones are still following, and the Israelite army is pursuing the Amorites. Now let's read a little bit about Ajalon. This is from Wikipedia. Following the conquest, the city of Ajalon was appointed to the tribe of Dan. That's in Joshua 19. And was designated as a Levitical city, Joshua 21. In spite of Joshua's initial victory in the nearby valley of Ajalon, the Philistines continued to live in the city of Ajalon, the Amorites / Philistines. That's interesting. Wikipedia says the Philistines were Amorites, I guess because they're a new tribe in the area. They continued to live there. Constant Philistine pressure to control the valleys of the Shephelah forced the tribe of Dan to retreat westward, reducing the extent of their territory. Eventually, the Danites abandoned their initial inheritance in the Ajalon area and moved to the extreme northern part of Israel, settling in the city of Laish, which they renamed Dan. So Dan originally had Beth Horon. The term Ajalon, now we'll read from Easton's Ajalon. The term Ajalon means place of deer. It's a town in a valley originally assigned to the tribe of Dan, from which, however, they could not drive the Amorites. This is in Judges 1:35, which is interesting. Joshua beat the mud out of the Amorites at Ajalon, in the valley of Ajalon, and yet the Amorites still managed to hang around, as recorded in Judges chapter 1. It was one of the Levitical cities given to the Kohathites. That's one of the families of Levi. It was not far from Beth Shemesh. It was the boundary between the kingdoms of Judah and Israel, and is frequently mentioned in Jewish history. With reference to the valley named after the town, Joshua uttered the celebrated command, Sun, stand thou still on Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon. In the Tel Amarna letters, now Tel Amarna is a place where Akhenaten, the son Pharaoh, the famous Pharaoh who broke with the standard Egyptian idolatry and became a monotheist of sorts. He worshipped the sun. He moved his capital out of Thebes, right to the north there. And his government sent a bunch of letters through the Egyptian Empire in Egypt at this time, approximately where we are now. Egypt controlled a lot of Palestine, Canaan. And so this is a very famous archaeological find. It's quoted all the time. So Tel Amarna letters speak of the destruction No, in Telemarner letters, Adonizedek speaks of the destruction of the city of Ajalon by the invaders and describes himself as afflicted, greatly afflicted, quote unquote, by the calamities that had come on the land, urging the king of Egypt to hasten to his help. Now, that's interesting archaeological proof of the historicity of these events. Now, Joshua spoke to the Lord, and then he spoke to the sun, and then he spoke to the moon. Did he speak to God first, or actually, did he speak to the Lord only, or did he speak to the Lord first and then to the sun? And he did that. That's what he did. He spoke to the Lord first and then to the sun at the Lord's instigation. Now notice he speaks to the sun and the moon. The Amorites worship sun and moon deities, and from this people have deduced that this might explain why God wanted to do this miracle at this time, to show that he was Lord over the sun and the moon. Just who's in charge here? Yahweh is. Not the sun, not the moon. Yahweh is in charge of the sun and the moon. Now let's address the problem of what it was that happened. It doesn't happen here until verse 13, but we'll take it up here. The sun stands still and the moon stands still in verse 13, but we'll take it up here. Here are some theories. And before I start on this, let me say there's more theories about this than my old dog Oliver had fleas. One theory after another. Let me categorize them by putting them into two basic categories. One is the literary theory, which says that this is a poem. It's not meant to be taken literally. So don't think that the sun actually stood still in the middle of the sky. The other line of argument over the millennia is that this physically happened. And then, of course, there's about 11 dozen theories as to how it happened. Now, I'm not a physicist. I'm not a scientist. And so these theories get over my head real quick. So I'm just going to list them for you in case you're interested in one day getting into an apologetics morass. And I'll have to admit it is kind of interesting. The scientific theories are very interesting. All right, with that introduction, let's talk about the first theory, that this was not a miracle, but it's just poetic language. The idea being that the Israelites fought so hard on that day, it seemed like 2 days of work in a row. Oh, the sun stood still because we're working so hard and time slowed down. And now, in favor of this theory, you can look at many printed English versions of the Bible, and you will see that the words are indented and printed stanza-like, like their poems. Now, I checked this out. I read this somewhere, and I checked it out on my computer, and unfortunately, all the computerized versions kill the spacing, the layout. So I went to my bookshelf to get some printed editions of the Bible, and again, recognizing that many printed editions might lay it out differently too, but I found a New King James Version, an English Standard Version, a New International Version, and the American Standard Version. They all have it listed as poetry, indented, one stanza, one line at a time. Now I found a KJV and a Berkeley translation that had it in line within the text. So it's not universal, but a lot of people have interpreted it as poetry. Now, going along with this poetry idea is the author of Joshua says the text came from the book of Jasher. I'm pronouncing the J like Yapa, Joppa. I think it's been anglicized. I think the way that Hebrews say it is Jasher. And some say the book of Jasher was a book of poems celebrating national events. And so you got a poem taken out of a book of poems. Now, the problem with that is some people say that Jasher is not a book of poems, but it's a book of narrative history. That's debatable. The big problem with this theory is verse 13, the next verse. Joshua 10:13 says this, "And the sun stood still, and the moon stopped." Well, that doesn't sound like poetry to me. If it is poetry, it's pretty prosaic. Isn't this written in the book of Jasher? And then, "So the sun stopped in the middle of the sky." Does that sound like poetry? "And the sun delayed its setting almost a full day." Now, gotquestions.org doesn't believe in this theory of poetry. In fact, they say it doesn't sound like poetry, and I agree. But I did thought I'd mention that the beginning of it does look like poetry. Well, let's look at some of the more physical explanations. Bernard Ram, the famous Christian apologist and theologian, said that the cloud shaded the sun. So when it says that the sun went down, it means the sun disappeared behind a cloud. So Joshua said, "O sun, disappear behind the cloud at Gibeon, and O moon, disappear behind the clouds in the valley of Ajalon," perhaps referring to atmospheric conditions that were related to that storm of hail that has recently occurred, or at the same time has occurred. Well, I guess that's plausible. The problem with it, though, is that that relief from the heat would have benefited the enemy as much as Israel. Another problem with this theory is it doesn't sound like something wonderful, but the author of Joshua in the next two verses next, Joshua 10:14 says this, "There was no day like that before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel." In other words, when the Lord listened to Joshua's ask for the sun to stand still, there was no day like that. It sounds like that's because it's a longer than 24-hour day. No day like that. Now, it could be it was no day like that because the Israelites had gotten such a big victory. I admit that does not necessarily kill this theory, but that's one theory, and it avoids all kinds of physics problems. Now, of course, you've got to have the verbs for stand still translated as be silent or be still or be inactive, which is a sort of poetic. We go to another theory. There was a solar eclipse. Well, the problem with that is eclipses of the sun last only for a few hours. And here the sun stopped for a whole day. So the idea behind this is Joshua says, "Be still in the sky, O sun," and boom, there's an eclipse. So it's still. You can't see it. But that can't be. Eclipses last just a few minutes. I've seen one from beginning to end. They don't last that long. Here's another theory. There was a refraction of light from beneath the horizon as the sun was about to go down. The sun goes below the horizon, and then clouds on the bright side of the earth reflected light up from the bright side of the earth back up to other clouds where Joshua was, and that light then was reflected to his eyes. So the light was miraculously bent from the other side of the earth through the use of so-called noctilucent clouds. I like that word, noctilucent. They shine at night. That actually doesn't sound like a bad idea to me. Much better than the solar eclipse one. Now, let me give you Velikovsky's theory. Now, Velikovsky is looked at like a nut job, but he was a brilliant guy. He was one of the founders of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He wrote a very famous book in the 1950s called Worlds in Collusion, which I saw when I was at the University of South Carolina about half a century ago, and I thought I'd like to read that one day. Never did. The mainstream scientific academic community think he's a nut job. They call his work pseudoscience. Well, they also think I'm a nut job, too, if I ever told them what I believed about Jesus rising from the dead. They say it's pseudoscience because he likes to go back and research ancient literature, and he uses ancient literature in with his scientific theories. Well, here's his theory. Venus veered close to the Earth at this time, and Venus was going in the opposite direction of the Earth's rotation, so the Earth caught the Venus gravitational field, and that caused the Earth to stop rotating. And then when the comet passed, the Earth started rotating again, thus explaining Joshua's long day. Well, the problem with that is the Earth stops rotating as Venus catches its field, but then as Venus leaves, the Earth's got to start rotating again. And Velikovsky says that's when a comet passes the Earth the other way and makes the Earth, well, actually in the same direction as Venus, I'm sorry, and makes the Earth start rotating again. Problem with that is the Earth has so much mass, how is it going to be started by a comet? And also, how could the Earth stop and start suddenly? The disturbances would be so great there would be earthly disasters that would ensue. People would go flying off the planet. The answer to Velikovsky's answer to that is, well, it was only the Earth's crust that stopped. But meanwhile, the interior of the Earth, which is liquid, kept spinning, following the Earth's normal rotation. Because the interface between the crust and the interior is liquid, and it allowed the crust to gradually slow down, which, of course, would then increase the length of Joshua's day. And then when the comet passes by, the Earth gradually speeds up again. And so everything's gradual, so it didn't make people fly around and fly off the planet. I have a problem with that, though. If you say the core of the Earth was kept on spinning as normal because the interface between the core and the landmass, the crust, is liquid, what about the interface between the atmosphere and the crust? That is liquid, too. And so if the crust slows down, it seems to me that the wind would keep going, in which case you'd have hurricane force winds all over the Earth flying people around. Again, I'm not a scientist. This is just what I'm thinking. Now, Velikovsky has something that's more interesting than that, in my opinion. He describes many places on earth that had an extra day or night in their traditional literature. Now, of course, if it's a longer day for Joshua on the other side of the globe from Joshua, it'd be a longer night. Now, if you look at a map of the earth, and the earth has a sine wave on it, and inside of one side wave, the sine wave that's at the top of the graph, under that sine wave it's dark, that's where it's night on the planet, and then you go to the right, and then you have the sine wave all the way down on the x-axis, and that's bright, and it's daytime there. You've seen these maps before. Well, Velikovsky went back and looked at a bunch of history and literature of ancient and modern tribes all over the earth, and this is what he said, quote, or this is what, actually, this is what somebody said about Velikovsky's reasoning. This author said, quote, "The links of his reasoning are forged out of the history and literature of ancient and modern tribes and nations from all over the earth. Text and footnotes sparkle with confirming data from the Bible and the Talmud, from Egyptian papyri, Babylonian astronomical tablets, Mayan and Aztec calendars, from the folklore of Arabia, India, North America, Tibet, China, and Peru." Now, of course, I can't check all that out, but let's assume that Velikovsky's is right. You then plot all these long day or long night stories in the ancient literature, and you plot them on a world map, and it's very interesting. In the part of the map where it's nighttime, all the places where such ancient stories about a long nighttime existing are all in the nighttime part of the graph. And the map I'm looking at has about 9 such places that had long night stories on the night side of the world. And on the day side of the world, which would include Israel, you have 5 extended day stories in the ancient literature, and they're all on the day side of the globe. I think that's of note. Now, Velikovsky's is a special case of a more general theory, which says that God just supernaturally slowed down the rotation of the earth without positing that Venus came near the earth, and then he gradually cranked it up again, gradually, so it wouldn't throw people for a loop who were living down here. Now, here's another theory. There is a precession in the earth's axis. Now, I can't show this on audio too well, but if you'll hold, I'll hold my right hand up as the sun. My left hand is the earth with Joshua facing the sun is daytime. The earth is starting to rotate, and the earth is tilted backwards on its axis. And as the earth rotates, and Joshua starts heading away from the rays of the sun, and it's getting nighttime, then the earth's axis tilts backwards. And even though the earth is still rotating, as the earth tilts backwards, it is able to catch more of the rays of the sun, which would make the day live longer. Now, I don't know what that would do to the surrounding physics, but at least it's plausible. At any rate, that's as much as I'm going to go into that interesting subject. Why was the day added longer if it was physically longer? It's because Joshua needed more time to map up the battlefield. And by the way, the moon standing still was a mere byproduct of the sun standing still. If one stands still, the other's going to have to stand still. Otherwise, the astronomy's going to get all screwed up. So we don't need to posit an extra problem to deal with the moon. So we go now to Joshua 10:13. "So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves of their enemies. Is it not written in the book of Jashar? And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day." I pronounced Jashar as Jashar because I just looked it up on the internet. And of course, nobody knows how to pronounce anything. There's no standard pronunciation for a lot of these ancient terms, but I like Jashar. So I'm changing from Yasher to Jashar. This book of Jashar, of course, has been lost. Nobody has it. It means, Jashar means the book of the upright. Here's some options as to what the book of Jashar contained. Option number 1. It was a book of military chronicles. As Adam Clark says, probably this was a book which, in reference to Joshua and his transactions, was similar to the commentaries of Caesar on his wars with the Gauls. Critics and commentators are greatly divided in their sentiments relative to the nature of this book. Well, some people say it's an anthology of national songs and poetry in honor of eminent heroes, and if that's true, of course, that would buttress the idea that this whole story of the sun standing still is a poem and not an historical narrative. The third option of the book of Jashar is that it was a general historical chronicle. That, of course, would buttress the idea that the sun standing still was history, not poetry. It says the sun stopped in the middle of the sky. Some people say that means it stopped at noon. Ah, but it could be that stopped at night. It would not go. The term middle is not precise enough to know exactly what time of the day that the sun stopped. The sun didn't go down, it says, for about a whole day. So that's a little fuzzy, too. Opinions vary as to how many hours were added to the day. Somewhere between 12 and 24 hours, you might find opinions. It doesn't matter to me. Now let's do the last two verses in Joshua 10, verses 14 and 15, and we'll finish this audio. There was no day like that before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp to Gilgal. Now, there was no day like that. This is Hebrew hyperbole. Actually, there was another long day. This was in Hezekiah's time, and that was a long time later after this. Hezekiah ruled from 715 or 716 B.C. to 686 or 687 B.C., and we're now around 1406 B.C., or so, 1404, whatever, somewhere around there. So we're talking about 700 years later, almost, or at least. And so you could literally say in verse 14, there was no day like that before or after it. But however, there's a problem with that. This is an artifact of the Hebrew language. Remember in the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said there'll be this days of vengeance and all there would be no day like it that's ever before or ever after would occur. No catastrophe ever before or ever after would occur. The problem with that is there was a disaster worse than what happened in AD 70 in the destruction of the Jerusalem, the worldwide flood, the Noah's flood, which was a worse disaster. And so the way you explain that is that that's just the way Hebrew people said, there's never been anything worse than this. Like, for example, you bring home an algebra test to your parents and they say, there has never been such a pitiful performance on a mathematical test as what you have just managed to do. Well, obviously that's not true. Not literally, but you get the idea. So again, this is just Hebrew hyperbole trying to say that, this was a day to remember. It's written down in the book of Jashar. Now we'll say this, the fact that this phrase is in there, no day like that before or after, does make it sound like something astronomical really happened. It wasn't just poetry saying this was a cloudy day or something like that, or a long day poetically. It makes it sound like, man, there's never been a long day like that. I mean, you could say there's never been a day like this in the fact that Israel knocked out five kings at once, maybe. And so that would save the poetic theory of the sun standing still. But I don't think so. I think it sounds like a physical standing still of the sun. It says, on that day, the Lord listened to the voice of a man. That would be Joshua. For the Lord fought for Israel. And Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp at Gilgal. Now, actually, it means they started to return. They had to do some other mopping up business first. They had to go down to the five kings who were holed up in the cave at Makkedah, which is below or south of Azekah. They got held up down there because they had to execute the five kings that were holed up in a cave down there. Now, it could be that this verse is not in its proper place. Adam Clark says, the verse is useless where it is, but appears to be an encumbrance to the narrative. In other words, it gets in the way of them going down there to the cave at Makkedah. The Septuagint actually leaves that verse out. And note that Joshua 10:43 says exactly the same thing. So Joshua and all Israel with them returned to the camp at Gilgal. So the speculation is somebody wrote down the same verse twice and stuck it in there. Textual error. Manuscript error. Maybe, maybe not. Doesn't bother me either way. We are now finished with Joshua chapter 10, verses 1 through 15. In our next audio, we'll take up Joshua 10, verses 16 through 43, in which section of Scripture we will see five Amorite kings executed, and then we will see the conquest of southern Canaan, which has already begun in this chapter, actually. Hope you stay tuned for that audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.